I was born in Liverpool, but at a very early age, when I was a very little girl, we must have come down to London, and we lived in a little villary house in Wandsworth Common. And the road in which we lived was then the last road before the country. Our little back garden looked out over fields. And one of my earliest recollections is seeing a farmer running after some boys with a stick who'd been stealing his apples. And of course it's now all built over, a huge suburb, but in those days it was country. And at the top of our road there was a lane, a little rutty, muddy lane, a regular country lane, and we went, my sister and I went along it once, we met some gypsies, and the boy spoke to us rather roughly, and we were simply terrified. We ran home crying, I remember that very well. I had a younger sister and an elder sister, but the elder sister, her life was quite separate from ours. Somehow, I don't quite know why, her temperament was very domineering, would have for a child who always got her own way. But my sister and I were known as the children, and we did everything together. And we went to a little kindergarten school, we were up the road, and we were told we should know the house because it was next door to a house with a canary in the window. So we always looked out for the house with the canary in the window and knew it was next door. And we were known in the school as the Threepenny Bits because we were so tiny. And I can remember sitting in the little room in this little house on a bench and seeing words, learning to spell by words chalked up on the board. And I can remember very well the word B-O-T written on the board. And I thought, that's very rude. And I was very horrified that I was asked to spell B-O-T because it seemed to be a very rude word. And we made little, we had slates with a little bit, a little handful of sand on them. And we learned to make with our fingers peninsulas and islands and bays in the sand. It was a very good way, I think, of children, teaching children the sort of formation of the land. And the next thing I can remember, I think, is the birth of my little brother. I was about five, I suppose, when he was born. And I had no idea, of course, that mother was going to have a baby. But I can remember awfully a most extraordinary sort of sensation. I can't exactly describe what it was. My father came and said, I'm going to take you up to see Mama, and she'll have a baby. And I said, oh, yes, I know. But I don't know how I knew or what, because I had no idea of where babies came from or anything about birth. But sure enough, there was Mother in bed. And I said to her, I can remember saying to her, how awfully lucky, Mama, that you're in bed when the baby came. Well, then, the next thing I remember is being ill. Because I was a very delicate child, rather a misery. I suffered with asthma and croup, and I had everything going that went. And my father, James Ashcroft Noble, was a great invalid too, and he was subject to periods of complete paralysis. And the doctors in those days didn't know what caused it, and he saw one of the greatest nerve specialist of the time. My father reviewed and worked for the Spectator under its editorship of Edward Hutton. And Mr. Hutton and several other people subscribed the fee of 150 guineas for this great nerve specialist to come and see my father. And when he came to this little suburban house, He told my mother that my father couldn't possibly live more than 6 months. And when mother handed him the check of 150 guineas, he returned it and wouldn't accept it. I do remember that. At least, of course, I must have been told that afterwards. But my father, as a matter of fact, recovered. Though he didn't recover then, I must tell you. Because my next recollection is of being ill with asthma. And my baby brother, a tiny little new baby. And my father ill, paralyzed, utterly helpless. Except that he could dictate his work to my mother. There were no typewriters, of course, in those days. And he used to lie in bed. And he used to dictate his reviews and his essays to my mother, who took them down. And then she used to go to the city with them, to the various editors and papers to which they belonged. I don't know how she managed it. Anyway, it was decided that we must go up north, because Southport, near Liverpool, the seaside place, was considered the best place for my father. And I remember most distinctly, we went in what was called then a saloon carriage, an invalid saloon carriage. It had a bed in it on which my father lay, a cot in it in which I lay, because I was ill, and the baby and the rest of the family. And we all bundled into this carriage. I can remember it very well. And of course it had a lavatory on board, which was a very unusual thing in a train in those days. And the family went, and we went straight from London to Southport, without, of course, any change. This carriage was sort of moved on the sidings when there was any necessity for it, and we just went straight ahead, and we got to the seaside, Southport. And I had been looking at pictures of the seaside, because I had no idea what it was like. And in our dining room, we had an etching of a seaport, with lots of ships and masts and men on wharves wheeling cargoes, about that kind of thing. And I thought, oh, how lovely the seaside would be. And when I saw at Southport a vast expanse of sand and then a grey sort of vast expanse of water, I howled with disappointment. We went to a lodging house in Southport. I think we had the whole house furnished, but it was one of those houses with a drawing room floor on the first floor. And looking there, my sister and I immediately got measles or mumps or one of those things, and we had to be confined in this drawing room on the first floor. And from those windows, I remember seeing my father walk for the first time. I'd never consciously seen him walk before. And he used to have a bath chairman called Rogers. And Rogers used to come and take him out of the bath chair, and Rogers helped him to walk, and he walked. And of course he gradually got better. We left the lodging house and took a house of our own at Southport. And that was a sort of semi-detached villa, and I can remember there, the great thing that I remember there is having my 10th birthday. Because it was a great occasion going into two figures. I was terribly thrilled about that. And my grandmama, my mother's mother, lived in Southport. She was a very severe old lady of the old Calvinistic type. And we were terrified of her, really. And on my birthday, which happened to be on a Sunday, my 10th birthday, I was told by my parents to take my presents round to Grandmama to show her, and it was Sunday. And one of my presents was a work basket. And when I took it in, Grandmama said to me, "We don't talk about work baskets on Sunday." And I was very much abashed, because, of course, in those days, and with my grandmother's beliefs, work in any form was barred on Sunday, or any frivolity of any kind. We were supposed to read the Bible or look at sacred picture books and not enjoy ourselves in any way at all. I can remember her very well. She sat all day by the fire in a beautiful black oak settle, and she had the most lovely, which I recognize now, lovely furniture, old furniture in her house. Her husband, my grandpapa, was a sailor. In the old, he was a sailor on, of course, a sailing ship, a whaler. And he spent years in the Arctic fishing for whales. And he was so long away sometimes that my grandmother got permission to remarry, count him as dead. But as a matter of fact, he turned up again, quite happily. And we simply adored him. He was a regular sort of fairy book sailor, a little stocky, white-haired man with gold earrings in his ears and a very stubbly white beard which pricked us when we kissed him. He was a sweet old thing. We simply adored him. Very different from my grandma, who he had married very much against, not against his will, of course, but against the will of his people, because his people were Quakers. And my grandmama was a Methodist, not a Quaker. And he was expelled from the Quakers for marrying somebody who wasn't a Quaker in those days. My own family, my father had been, at one time, his parents had wanted him to go into the church, and he had actually trained. But his conscience wouldn't let him for the Church of England. But he couldn't accept the 39 articles, so he hadn't gone into the church. But he often used to preach as a lay preacher in churches. He was very interested in it. But he later became a Unitarian, and I was brought up as a Unitarian. Both my parents were Unitarians. And Southport was a stronghold of Unitarians in those days. And there were some. We used to go to a little church, I remember, which was packed. Then, of course, time went on, and I grew big enough, and my sister, to go to school. And the name of the school was Wintersdorf. It was kept by two maiden ladies named Miss Simon, Miss Mary and Miss Sarah Simon. And they were extremely intellectual women, very progressive, I mean, and very original in their ideas of education. The school was a very remarkable one in that it was extremely influenced by the artistic movements which were going on at the time under the influence of Oscar Wilde, the aesthetic movement, it was called, and the one that's made fun of in the Gilbert and Sullivan's Patience, of course, where everybody wore greenery, yellowy, Grosvenor Gallery dresses, and we all wore smocked blue or green or rust-coloured smocked dresses. There was no uniform, of course, in those days, but this was the thing to do. We went in tremendously for art. It was an expensive, rich school, but my parents became very great friends of Miss Simon's, and I think we were allowed to go for very small fees. It was we went as day children, though it was a boarding school. And we, literature figured largely among the subjects which were taught. And for instance, it was originally that we got prizes. There was a prize given every year for the best sonnet written by a girl. I never got the sonnet prize, my sister did. And the prizes were generally beautiful reproductions of pictures or little Grecian statuettes or something of that kind. And we actually had Oscar Wilde there to talk to us on the Home Beautiful. This school, we were taught deportment, and I learned many useful things there, which I've remembered all my life. One of them was how to meet an acquaintance in the street. You saw her coming some distance away, and you at once began to prepare a smile on your face, which came to its fullest extent as you passed her with a slight bow of the head. And then when you passed her, your face was allowed to relax into its ordinary expression again. Well, this was in 1887, and I was 10. And I was at this school with my sister, and both my sisters. My elder sister was a very bright and shining light, and so was my younger sister. I wasn't. I was very stupid and very self-conscious and very unhappy, really, because I felt that they were both very clever and brilliant and acclaimed because of brains at this school counted before anything else, and I didn't feel I had any brains. But one day, we were given an essay to write. And this essay was supposed to describe a voyage round the British Isles, or around part of the British Isles, in a ship. Well, I'd never been in a ship in my life, and I had no idea, but I wrote the essay. And to my extreme astonishment, unbelief, in fact, I came out top. And that was my first literary experience. I used to, when my father and mother went away, I used to write to them every day. And one of the proudest days of my life, when I was about this age, I shall never forget it, was when they'd gone to Ireland to stay with my father's great friend, Professor Edward Dowden, in Dublin. I used to write to him, and he wrote back to me and said, "My dear Nelly, you are the queen of letter writers." And I was so thrilled. I shall never forget that. And it gave me great pleasure, because I adored my father. I simply adored him. And, of course, being an invalid and being a writer, he didn't have to go to his office and to an office like other fathers did. He was always at home, reading aloud to us or talking to us. Or my father was, I was going to say a typical Victorian, but if there is such a thing. He was tall and slight, very rather delicate-looking, with reddish auburny hair and a reddish auburny beard and moustache, of course. And he had great humour and great charm. He was very, very popular. He couldn't go about himself because he was an invalid, but all sorts of interesting people used to come to the house, writers and publishers and all sorts of people, because he was a very great talker and amusing and lively and delightful creature altogether. Very different from my mother, who was a little practical, commonsensical North Country woman. Well, she had to be, because my father's an invalid, you see, and she had to bear the whole brunt of everything, really, because he was completely unpractical and used to give away a lot of money and things which we couldn't afford, and so she had to be the practical one of the house. He wrote all day and every day of all his life, as far as I can remember. He wrote reviews, he wrote essays, he wrote poems, mostly reviews. He used to review, when we were living in Southport, he did the whole literary reviewing for a paper called the Manchester Examiner. It was a very remarkable newspaper, I believe, though of course I was too little to read it. But I've heard that it had this wonderful literary page, and my father reviewed everything for it. Every month we used to get an enormous hamper from the Manchester Examiner full of books that had been published. All the books that had been published, except technical books or school books, but all the fiction, all the belles-lettres, biographies, so on, used to come in this huge hamper, along with the most lovely children's books, and along also with the most wonderful illustrated magazines which were issued in those days. And my father then could pick out what he wanted to review and reviewed it. And the rest of the books he sold. and they were sold to a man in Pinna. And the Pinna man became a sort of mythological character with us children, because we knew that on him depended a certain amount of my father's livelihood, because the sale of review books brought in quite a bit. And the Pinna man took all the review copies. And of course, in those days, there were 3-volume novels. My father reviewed Thomas Hardy, for instance, as he came out in 3 volumes. I remember A Pair of Blue Eyes, for instance. And we had this wonderful hamper to delve into and fish books out of, novels and children's books and poems, all sorts of things. After Edward's death, I went to stay with my sister, who lived in Chiswick. And her neighbours were New Zealanders. And she didn't know them at all, but she mentioned to them the death of her brother-in-law. And a most extraordinary thing happened. A New Zealand soldier had been told about these people that they would give him hospitality on his leaves, and he came to them. And it happened that he was a member, one of the soldiers of Edward's battery, and had knew Edward, and had been there present at his death. And I met this New Zealander, and he told me about Edward's death, how he, after the battle, he was standing at the door of his dugout in the early morning, smoking his pipe, when a stray shell, German shell, came by, and the blast of it killed him, stopped his heart beating. And he fell at his... he was in the forward observation post, one of the most dangerous posts, I believe, in an artillery attack. And he fell there, and this man told me that he'd come into his comrades in the trenches, or wherever they were, and said, "Our best man has gone." And they all said, "Oh, not Mr. Thomas." He was very, very popular with the men. And it was so remarkable that I should meet this man who had actually come into contact with Edward. And he told me how popular he was, how they felt they could talk to him as they couldn't talk to any of the other officers, because Edward talked to them as man to man, with no question of his rank, his officer's uniform being interposing between them. And they told me they loved talking to him about country things, what the best time to put in the potatoes, what the best kind of tobacco was, and they loved him dearly. And especially, he had to lecture to them, this man told me, on warning them against the women of the place, which he did in a very sensible sort of man-to-man way, with no humbug about it. And also he had them, he had the job of censoring their letters. And this man said he'd never forget Edward's talks on these two subjects, which endeared him very much to the men. And I had very many letters from the men in his battery, some of them very illiterate, but all full of affection and admiration for him, which was very comforting for me. I lived in the country, in this little village, doing my house and garden and looking after my children. But I was all the time really getting rather ill. I often didn't feel very well, and it culminated in a very bad sort of nervous breakdown. And I got very ill, and the doctor advised me to go to live in London, to leave the country. And I very foolishly took his advice and went to London and lived in a house on Hampstead Heath. And there, feeling utterly desolate, I began to write my book. I first of all wrote the chapter dealing with the birth of my child, because I thought it was a thing that no woman had ever done. But I wrote it really to comfort myself in my utter loneliness and misery in London. I hadn't been so miserable in the country, but in London, I felt utterly alone and miserable, and I wrote my book to fill up my time and comfort myself. Heinemann's, when they had the manuscript, they weren't quite sure about publishing it. And they sent the manuscript round to a few of the people they had great faith in. I remember one of them was Galsworthy. And Galsworthy disapproved of the book. However, he was the only one of the little people, the committee that Charlie Evans had sent the manuscript round to, and he decided to publish it in spite of Galsworthy's disapproval. The first book was published, and then Mr. Evans, who was the head of Heinemann's, very much wanted more and asked me if I had written any more. As a matter of fact, I had, but I had no idea of having published any of it. But still, I had a little, and he begged me to go on with it, and so I did. They were received awfully well. Mr. Evans was very enthusiastic himself about them and did everything he could to publicize them. He got Harold Nicholson and Miss Sackville West to write very laudatory reviews of them. And they themselves wrote to me saying how much they'd liked the book, and it was extremely well received, and I was very thrilled and excited, but it was all very surprising for me. One of the great satisfactions in my life is to know, of course I've been told many times, that my book introduced people to Edward's work, and that Edward's reputation as a poet has been helped by that book. That gives me enormous pleasure and satisfaction. I feel my life has not been quite in vain. It was just before the war that Robert Frost came to England, quite unknown to us, but he published a book. I think it was called A Boy's Will, but of that I'm not very certain. And Edward reviewed it, and I think through that review, Robert got into contact with Edward, and they met. I think Robert at the time was living in Beaconsfield. But after some time, after Edward met him several times, it was arranged that the Frost should go and spend a holiday in the country, in Herefordshire, and that we should go and join them too. And on the day that actually a war was declared, August the 4th, 1914, I took the children down to the little village near Ledbury, and Edward and Mervyn had already gone on before on bicycles to where the Frosts were living in a little village whose name I can't remember. And there we stayed near neighbours to the Frosts for about a couple of months, I think. The Frosts were living in a little empty, almost empty cottage, which they furnished with the barest necessities, because they were very, very poor. And we had rooms in a farmhouse, and we met every day and all day long. We were together all the time. And Edward and Robert got extremely devoted to each other. I used to talk about poetry and literature all day long, and go long walks, and Mrs. Frost and myself and the children met every day and were together. And in the evenings we used to sit round the floor, around the wall of the floor of the Frost cottage, and either talk or sing folk songs or something of that kind. And our whole association was very happy indeed. He was a strange man. I never got to know him very intimately. He had a very quick temper, and I remember that We were suspected by the villagers of being spies. Can't think why, except that we had come in the middle of... I had come with the children in the middle of the night because the journey from Petersfield to Ledbury had been so awful on the day that war was declared that I didn't arrive there till midnight. And the villagers thought it very strange that I had a Russian boy who was spending the holidays with us. And they also thought that Robert's very American accent was a foreign accent. And altogether, they thought it was rather queer, and they thought we were spies. And the policeman came round to interview us. He said, of course, we know this is nonsense, but we are obliged by law to inquire into anything of this kind. And Edward treated the whole thing as a great joke. But Robert was furious. And when the policeman came around one evening and peeped in at the window of the cottage, Robert said, if he comes again, I shall shoot him. And he was very strange in that sort of way, very quick-tempered and intolerant and suspicious of any authority. For instance, when he was leaving England later, as he did, he was asked to leave his fingerprints and made the most terrific scene about it and wouldn't do it for a long time until he was persuaded to. He was a quick-tempered man, but delightful to meet and living a completely simple domestic life, utterly unpractical, really, with his children. Mrs. Frost would say in the middle of the afternoon, well, wonder what we shall have for dinner today. I don't think we've got anything in the house. Perhaps I'd better peel a few potatoes. And she would go in the field and with a bucket of potatoes would peel a few potatoes. And about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, we would sit down and eat these. And when war was declared and there was some talk of a shortage of food, Robert went into the nearest town and bought about 50 boxes of shredded wheat and a large tin of very cheap fancy biscuits as provender for the cottage. And the children used to, when they got hungry, they used to just take a shredded wheat out of the packet and eat it to fill themselves up when there were no meals available. I was living at Otford, a little village near Sevenoaks, in a charming old cottage there, and a friend of mine asked me if I would like to meet D.H. Lawrence, and I said, yes, I would, very much. So he suggested bringing him down for a weekend, which he did. And I was very surprised when I first saw Lawrence, a tall, deathly pale man with a red beard. He looked almost dying, he looked so delicate. But he came in and was most genial and charming guest. And I, of course, did all the work and was preparing the dinner and made quite a simple meal, which he praised very much. He praised my cooking. He said, the only thing is, flaw in the banquet or meal is that the hostess hasn't given enough thought to her own appearance. And I got quite a tidy frock on. I may have kept my apron, I can't remember. Anyway, he said, I like to see a woman perfectly groomed and perfectly confident of her appearance and perfectly gracing a meal, however simple. And I felt very much rebuffed. But at that meal, he made a remark which I shall never forget. We were talking about, dress, woman's dress. He was very interested in it. And he, as a matter of fact, made a great deal of his wife's clothes and was very interested in them. And his wife had a wonderful evening dress given her from a friend had given her. And Lawrence had had unpicked it and remade it. And he said, unpicking a Poirot gown is like unpicking Reims Cathedral. I always remembered that. And he unpicked it and made it again into a dress for her. And that was a rather an amusing sidelight on his character. He was very nice to the children. Anne was at home. She was a little girl of about 5 or 6. And he showed her pictures. And I had a volume of pictures, reproductions, prints, small prints of Goya's pictures, Spanish, and a lot of them were of battles and fighting or bullfights or something. And he wouldn't let her look at those. He only showed her the pictures which he thought she would like and which he himself approved of. He wouldn't let her see any of the horrors at all. I remember that. And she was very, very fond of him. And later on, some time after, she electrified a party. They were all boasting about things they'd done when they were children. And she said, well, I have slept with D.H. Lawrence. As a matter of fact, in the morning, early in the morning, when he was still in bed, she got into his bedroom and she climbed into bed with him and they'd talked. And he was perfectly sweet with little children. Didn't condescend to them, but interested in them, and she was very devoted to him. He also taught me, took me into the garden and showed me how to prune gooseberry bushes, which I was very glad to learn. I had no idea how to do it, and he showed me how to do it. He was a very practical man, a man who loved domestic things, and of course that appealed to me very much in him. But a side of his him, which distressed me rather, he had a very high, unpleasant laugh, a very cruel laugh, it seemed to me. And he talked of some of his people that he knew, whom I also knew, who I knew had been very kind to him. He talked about them in a very sneering, unkind, rather cruel way, which rather distressed and upset me. But on the whole, I liked him very much. Oh, and as we were he was going, I told him about my eldest daughter, who was still at Bede's, and what a trial she was to me. I didn't know what to do with her. She'd no idea of any career or what to do. After she was leaving school, she was just on the point of doing so. And he said, well, what are her interests? And I said, her chief interest is dress. And he said, well, can't you turn that to some useful channel? And I said, well, she draws quite well. That's one of the subjects school she's good at. So he suggested that I should send her to an art school to study dress designing, which I did. It wasn't a success because she didn't work, but it was a very good idea, and he was awfully helpful and nice. He wrote me a charming letter after he'd been stay with me and said how much he'd enjoyed it, and he was afraid he'd talk too much, but I liked him very much. I saw him once or twice in London afterwards, but with his wife, and we never with other people, of course, in a party, and he and his wife Frieda, who was a big, rather fat, indolent woman. I liked her very much, though. He was devoted to her, but they were always a little bit sparring at each other, getting at each other. And I can remember his saying, Frieda, your petticoat's showing. And she made some rather flippant remark. And there was just a little sort of feeling of not being, of being a little bit at each other all the time, which made me a bit uncomfortable. My father's study was the sort of great gathering place in the house. I mean, we didn't have a drawing room. My father's study was the place where people met and talked and where the family lived. Because my father, though he was a writer and wrote all day, couldn't bear to be alone. He loved having the family around him. And sometimes when mother would whisper to us, I think you ought to leave your father alone. I think we're making too much noise. He used to creep out and go into another room. And Father used to come trundling after us and make us all go back again. He liked writing like us. He liked writing with the family all around him. Well, the time I'm speaking of now, we were back again in London. We were then living at the same district, Wandsworth Common, only we'd moved to a slightly bigger house with a lovely garden with a cherry tree in it, I remember. And I suppose my father's getting a little bit more prosperous because it was a much bigger, sort of grander house. And there, my father and mother hadn't become Unitarians, and I think, because we used to go all the way from Wandsworth Common on Sunday to a chapel, a congregational chapel. It was in the Buckingham Palace Road, so from Wandsworth Common we had to walk to Clapham Junction Station. Then we had to take a train from there to Victoria, and then walk from Victoria to Buckingham Palace Road to this chapel. Every Sunday we used to do that. It used to take about an hour and a half to get there and an hour and a half to get back. Later, we went to another chapel in Bloomsbury Square, presided over by the Stopford Brooke, a very well-known Irish intellectual. And this chapel was the great gathering place of the intellectuals of the time. Mrs. Humphrey Ward and people like that used to go there. And that chapel was in Bloomsbury Square. And we used to take the train then from Clapham Junction to Waterloo. And in those days, there was a little bus running across Waterloo Bridge, a horse bus, a halfpenny bus. It cost a halfpenny to go Waterloo Bridge. And you got into the bus, there was no conductor. It was a little one-horse bus. And you just put your halfpenny in the little box at the end of the bus. And it took you to the other side of the bridge. And from there, we used to walk to Bloomsbury Square to hear Stopford Brooke preach. He gave some very famous series of lectures about Tennyson in those days. Not sermons, they were literary lectures, really, and people used to come from all over the place to hear him. And Americans used to come in the middle of the services and walk around the church and make comments, quite loud voices, and point to the various people in the church, and then walk out again. I can remember that as a girl. My last school was the Wimbledon High School. It was one of the schools run by the Girls Public School Trust, and was a very exceptional school and had a wonderful headmistress. I wasn't happy there. I was never happy at school. I loathed school for the same reason I always had, because my sisters were so much more brilliant than myself. But I loved there. My love of literature was very much stimulated by a beloved literature teacher, Miss Fowler, her name was, and I blossomed forth in that, though I didn't blossom forth in anything else. But I left there when I was about 16, because I so hated school. I begged and implored my parents to let me leave, which I did do much earlier than my sisters. And I was at home with my mother, helping mother, in our house, where we had then, I don't know why I was there to help, because we had two maids, Annie and Fanny Wilde, their name were. They were sisters. And they were with us for years. And mother was a very strict mistress, but they were devoted to her, and she to them. She never let them off anything. I can see her now when she came in at the front door, looking along the hall table to see if it was dusty, and marking it with her finger. And if her finger showed any marks in the dust, then Annie or Fanny got it. But they were awfully nice girls, and we shared our life with them. I mean, we were never, never allowed to be anything but scrupulously polite to them. But on the other hand, we were never allowed to be familiar with them, nor they with us. And on birthdays, for instance, we used to always, when we looked at our presents, take them into the kitchen to show the maids. And at Christmas and so on. And once a week, my mother would go into the kitchen, and we would go in too, and we would all sit round. The mother would read to the girls. She read Victorian novels, particularly I remember The Mill on the Floss and Middlemarch by George Eliot, and they loved it, and it was all very nice and cosy and homely. They adored my father, who sometimes strode in to join in the family reading. He was a most genial creature, and they loved him very much. And it was an awfully happy atmosphere there at home. My mother, and with Annie and Fanny, there was a... mother was very strict to them, and they both had young men, but they had to come and interview mother, and she spoke to them and asked them questions and looked at them and generally vetted them and gave her approval. And they were allowed to come once a week to see the girls, and they were allowed, of course, to go out with them on their days off. And one of them, I forget which, Annie or Fanny, was going to be married, and a man came to the door selling sewing machines. In those days, higher purchase was quite unheard of, but he offered her this machine on weekly payments. And she put down the first installment. Then she very timidly told my mother what she'd done. And mother was furious, absolutely furious. She said she wouldn't have Annie buying anything at the door. It'd be sure to be rubbish, and she was paying much too much for it. And she, when the man came round for his next installment, she interviewed him and so browbeat him that he not only signed out the contract, but gave the first installment back to Annie. And mother bought the sewing machine, not from him, of course, but from a shop. For Annie, and she paid mother for it. We read a great deal at home. Of course, we were surrounded by books, but it was a great family tradition to read aloud a great deal. And both my mother and my father read aloud to us children. And father used to do it at meal times, because being so delicate, he hardly ever ate anything, and he'd finished long before we had. And he used to light a cigarette, and while we finished our meal, he would read aloud to us. And then in the evening, when he was busy writing, it didn't interrupt him or interfere with him at all. Mother used to read aloud to us. She generally read something of Dickens or Anthony Trollope or Jane Austen or one of the Victorian novelists like Walter Besant. And, we read tremendously. That really was a great part of our life when we were children. Well, it was in this London house that, we used to go to a Unitarian church family, father, mother, and all of us. And there was another family named Thomas who used to come, father, mother, and five, six boys. And we didn't know them, but they were rather striking looking, some of them. And the minister of the church, a man named Mr. Tarrant, introduced my father to the father of this family of Thomas's, telling him that the eldest son wanted to be a writer, and he had told the father that if he sent his son to my father's, he would see if his work was really worth anything and would justify his taking up a literary career. So Edward came to the house, and he went into my father's study, which was all the sort of room where people did go. And we girls were rather giggly and curious about him, because we'd already heard and we'd already nicknamed him the genius. I can't quite remember why, but I suppose Mr. Tarrant had told my father he was a rather remarkable young man. Anyhow, I went into father's study to see him, and just as I opened the door, there was Edward standing in the door by the bookshelf, very tall, very good-looking, and very shy and reserved, and we shook hands. And I remember very well indeed
that he shook my hand very firmly and hard, and I liked that. And I thought, well, yes, you look rather perhaps shy and timid, but you don't shake hands as if you were at all flabby, and I liked it. And I stayed there and listened to Father and Edward talking, and then left them. And he came several times, and every time that he came, I was attracted by him. I went into the study to join in the talk, which was all about books, of course, and writing. And Edward at the time was, he had written a book about nature, a sort of nature diary. And it was obvious that he told my father how interested he was in to do with wildlife, and how he used to go tremendous walks in the country round London, which was then a great deal more than it is now. And Father one day said, here's Helen, who's longing for the country. Why don't you take her on one of your walks? So Edward said he would, and I was very keen. And so that was how it all began. We went to Malden, I think it was. Anyway, one of those places that are now suburbs of London. They were completely country in those days. Oh, no, Merton. Merton it was, because I remember the lavender fields there where the lavender grows. Merton lavender. And it were all hedges and lanes and fields, no houses, except little villages. And then we did this several times, you see. We got to know each other and got more and more intimate, and Edward talked to me mostly about books, but also about nature. And I remember very well his telling me, oh, he lent me a book about birds. And in it there was an illustration of birds, lots of illustrations of birds, but one particularly, the picture of the blue tit. And I'd never seen a blue tit, as far as I knew, and I couldn't believe that such a brilliant bird was an English bird. And it surprised me very much to find it was a common little wild bird. And Edward, I remember, was very amused at my awful ignorance of birds and flowers and everything, because I'd never been in the country, you see. So I enjoyed these walks tremendously, and I remember being very pleased that my shoes got covered with mud and my skirts got covered with bits of grass and burrs and things, because we scrambled about in hedges. And I came home feeling very countrified and happy. Father was simply delighted. But he didn't live very long after that. He was very fond of Edward, and he was delighted that he and Edward and I were getting being so friendly. Though he'd no idea then that we should marry, ever. My mother was very antagonistic to Edward. She was very jealous of him, for one thing, because my father was so very fond of him. And he didn't appeal to her in the least. She didn't like shy, reserved people. She liked open, boisterous, typical English boys. She liked those very much, but she didn't care for it a bit. My father, all this time, was very, very delicate, and he became ill and died, and the home broke up. My mother and I were antagonistic to each other. In fact, none of her daughters got on with her very well, because she didn't really care for girls. She liked boys much better. So I left home, and I got a job in a part of London called Bedford Park, which was then the sort of centre of the artistic intellectuals. They were rather well-to-do, and they were disciples of William Morris and Burne Jones, and everything was rather like that. Morris designs and Burne Jones dresses. And I was there, a governess. Well, while I was there, I was introduced to a circle who lived at Hammersmith. And I was absolutely enchanted and enraptured by the people I met there. Because they expressed a different life from any I'd ever been used to. Utterly un-Victorian, utterly free, at least as far as their own conventions would allow them to be free, because they were very, very unconventional in dress, in manners and everything. But I loved them. I loved their great spacious rooms with very little furniture in them and beautiful hangings and spaciousness. And I liked their freedom with each other. And freedom, there was a good deal of what is called free love. My host and hostess weren't married. They lived together. And she had been married before. She had three lovely daughters. And my sister, who was very scornful about the whole thing, said it was a society where you shook hands with a woman and kissed the men. They made a rather a show of frankness and camaraderie. Well, Edward simply hated that and a bit laughed at it, laughed at all their, a good many of their ideas. And they laughed at him for the opposite reasons, that he couldn't enter into their conventions and self-conscious friendships and camaraderie and that kind of thing.
Old man or lad's love? In the name there's nothing to one that knows not lad's love or old man. The hoar-green feathery herb, almost a tree, growing with rosemary and lavender. Even to one that knows it well, the names half decorate, half perplex the thing it is. At least what that is clings not to the names in spite of time. And yet I like the names. The herb itself I like not, but for certain I love it as some day the child will love it who plucks a feather from the doorside bush whenever she goes in or out of the house. Often she waits there, snipping the tips and shriveling the shreds at last onto the path, perhaps thinking, perhaps of nothing, till she sniffs her fingers and runs off. The bush is still but half as tall as she, though it is as old, so well as she clips it. Not a word she says, and I can only wonder how much hereafter she will remember of that bitter scent of garden rose and ancient damson trees topping a hedge, a bent path to a door, a low thick bush beside the door, and me forbidding her to pick. As for myself, where first I met the bitter scent is lost, I too often shrivel the grey shreds, sniff them and think and sniff again and try once more to think what it is I am remembering, always in vain. I cannot like the scent, yet I would rather give up others more sweet with no meaning than this bitter one. I have mislaid the key. I sniff the spray and think of nothing. I see and hear nothing, yet seem too to be listening, lying in wait for what I should, yet never can remember. No garden appears, no path, no hoar-green bush of lad's love or old man, no child beside, neither father nor mother nor any playmate, only an avenue, dark, nameless, without end. Tall nettles cover up, as they have done, these many springs, the rusty harrow, the plough long worn out, and the roller made of stone. Only the elm butt tops the nettles now. This corner of the farmyard I like most. As well as any bloom upon a flower, I like the dust on the nettles, never lost except to prove the sweetness of a shower. out of us all that make rhymes, will you choose sometimes as the winds use a crack in a wall or a drain, their joy or their pain to whistle through? Choose me, you English words. I know you. You are light as a dream, tough as oak, precious as gold, as poppies and corn, or an old cloak. Sweet as our birds to the ear, as a burnet rose in the heat of midsummer. Strange as the races of dead and unborn. Strange and sweet equally, and familiar to the eye as the dearest faces that a man knows, and as lost homes are. But though older far than oldest you, as our hills are old, worn new again and again, young as our streams after rain, and as dear as the earth which you prove as we love, make me content with some sweetness from Wales, whose nightingales have no wings, from Wiltshire and Kent and Herefordshire and the villages there, from the names and the things, no less. Let me sometimes dance with you, or climb, or stand perchance in ecstasy, fixed and free in a rhyme, as poets do. Oh, I think I'll read this one. It's called October. The green elm with the one great bough of gold lets leaves into the grass slip one by one. The short hill grass, the mushroom small, milk white, harebell and scabious and tormentil, the blackberry and gorse and dew and sun bow down to. And the wind travels too light to shake the fallen birch leaves from the fern. The gossamers wander at their own will. At heavier steps than birds the squirrels scold. The rich scene has grown fresh again anew as spring, and to the touch is not more cool than it is warm to the gaze. And now I might as happy be as earth is beautiful, were I some other, or the earth could turn in alternation of violet and rose, harebell and snowdrop in their season's dew, and gorse that has no time not to be gay. But if this be not happiness, who knows? Some day I shall think this a happy day, and this mood by the name of melancholy shall no more blacken than obscure it be. Adlestrop. Yes, I remember Adlestrop, the name, because one afternoon of heat, the express train drew up there unwontedly. It was late June. The steam hissed, someone cleared his throat. No one left and no one came on the bare platform. What I saw was Adlestrop, only the name, and willows, willow herb and grass, and meadowsweet and haycocks dry, no whit less still and lonely fair than the high cloudlet in the sky. And for that minute a blackbird sang close by, and round him mistier, further and further, all the birds of Oxfordshire and Gloucestershire. Sewing. It was a perfect day for sewing, just as sweet and dry was the ground as tobacco dust. I tasted deeply ah, between the far owl's chuckling first soft cry and the first star. A long stretched hour it was, nothing undone remained. The early seeds all safely sown. And now hark at the rain, windless and light, half a kiss, half a tear, saying good night.